Welcome to In Reality, the podcast about truth, disinformation, and the media. I'm Eric Schoenberg, a longtime journalist and media executive, now the founder of the Alliance for Trust in Media. Sorry I've been away for a couple of weeks. My dad, Carl Schoenberg, died some days ago, and as you can imagine, that threw me off. He was a great guy, and I'll really miss him. Now, to figure out what's true and what's not in today's chaotic, fragmented, contradictory information environment, all of us news consumers have to think like journalists. Is that story I'm seeing backed by evidence? Is the headline fair? Is the coverage biased? Well, we could do worse than to think like the journalist who is today's guest. Until his retirement in February 2021, Martin Baron was the editor of the Washington Post, following remarkable stints leading the Boston Globe and Miami Herald. Altogether, teams under his editorship amassed more than 24 Pulitzer Prizes, including one story at the Globe that became the subject of an Oscar-winning movie, Spotlight. Marty and I will talk about that and other stories. We'll focus on what it was like covering the Trump administration, what the ownership of Jeff Bezos meant to the Washington Post's coverage, and how high-stake decisions are made in the newsroom of a national daily in this highly charged era. The first voice you'll hear is that of Seth Green, the dean of the University of Chicago's Graham School, which hosted the interview. And Seth will give me a chance to introduce the Alliance for Trust in Media. And now here comes In Reality's interview with Marty Baron.
From one of the people that was a stalwart in making sure that journalism continued to have its highest values and continued to hold public trust in one of the most disruptive decades in history. First, Marty Baron, who really needs no introduction, but I'll say he was a longtime journalist. He then ran the newsrooms at the Miami Herald and Boston Globe before becoming the executive editor of the Washington Post in 2013 and having the joy and the exhaustion of leading that paper, as you know in his book, Collision of Power, through the Trump era, or one, potentially, of the eras. We have Eric Schoenberg, who we know as a distinguished instructor of journalism at the Graham School as part of the new suite of opportunities that have been added over the past couple of years. He, before this, was the CEO of Mansueto Ventures, where he was the head of both Inc. and Fast Company, and prior to that, a longtime business journalist. Today, though, he is going to be sitting in his role as the head of the Alliance for Trust in Journalism, which I personally think is one of the most important initiatives that this country has around how we restore trust in a very important institution. And so maybe I can turn it over to you, and maybe you can say a little bit about the Alliance to put you on the spot before you get into your conversation with Marty.
Thank you, Seth. And And thank you for teeing up a topic that is the thing that occupies my mind more than anything else these days. Now look, all of us are aware that trust in professional journalism is at near catastrophic lows, and that without the grounding in truth that standards-based journalism has traditionally provided Americans, it's very hard for us to agree on a common set of facts. And without a common set of facts, democracy can't survive. So the Alliance for Trust in Media tries to bring Americans back to a shared reality by helping newsrooms bring back trust with their audiences and also helping Americans navigate what is an increasingly chaotic information environment.
I want to put just a little bit of data around that warm introduction that Seth did for Marty. So 2001, Marty is at the Miami Herald, and his team wins a Pulitzer Prize for a story about Elian Gonzalez. Then he moves to the Boston Globe, where he racks up 6 more Pulitzers with his team, including a story that was the subject of a movie about sexual abuse in the Boston Archdiocese and beyond. Then he gets snatched up by the Washington Post, where he has another 10 Pulitzer Prizes, including, among many others, the exposure of Roy Moore, the conservative judge who was running for Senate, for alleged sexual abuse of teenage girls. Now, what is not often recorded in Marty's stellar CV is that I'd wager that among all the people in this room, he is the only one who has ever found an answer to the question that all of us have asked ourselves. In the movie of my life, who is the actor who will play me? You know, Marty, when I ask people what it was like or what it would be like talking to you, what they said, including some people who are in this room, said, just watch Spotlight. So you've met Liev Schreiber.
Yes.
Then what was that like?
Well, the first meeting, he came to the Washington Post. It was purportedly an interview for him to interview me, but the script had already been written. So I quickly realized that it was an observation session. He wanted to see what I was like, how I talked, how I spoke. By the way, I wasn't that bad in the first meeting, that first scene there. I'm absolutely sure of that. And I think he actually watched the way I walked and all of that stuff. And then he started, like, suggesting that perhaps his role should be bigger and that maybe he wanted to know if I, like, did you ride your bike to work? I said no. He would ask a few other things, and I kept saying no. And he kept arguing that it should be a bigger role. And I said, well, you know, Liev, you should talk to Tom McCarthy, your friend, about that, not to me. But it was interesting. I didn't tell anybody in the newsroom that he was coming. And before you knew it, there were a bunch of people. He was facing out of a glass window, glass office, and I was facing in. But there were these people going right by, all women going right by the window. And one, I was told later that one of the women went by first with her hair up and then with her hair down. And then my publisher complained afterwards. She was a single mom, very good looking, and she complained that I did not introduce her to him. And I said that I was, so I had to come up with something. I said I was protecting Naomi Watts. Anyway, it was good. He came to my book launch party. It was very nice. We concluded that we are the same person. And he does narrate the book, everything except the prologue and the epilogue.
Yes.
And when the New York Times named it Audiobook of the Week, they noted that I had done the prologue and the epilogue, and they said it was really good of me to delegate to him the reading of the remainder of the book. So,
well, look, I was going to ask if you were disappointed that he wasn't better looking, but I guess that answers the question.
The fact is, he's taller, he's more fit, and he's better looking. And when people hear my name, if they think of him, I'm fine with that.
You know, he is now on a play, on Broadway.
Yeah, I saw it. I went backstage and we had drinks afterwards. Yeah.
Good. Doubt, but if you don't know, is a play about a priest who's accused of sexual abuse. Yeah. I don't know if that rises to the level of coincidence with Spotlight.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I told him I was coming and I was going to see him on stage, and we were exchanging some notes, and he said, by the way, he didn't do it.
I know to play that role, you have to make the decision, although it's not clear from the play. All right, let's talk about you. Let's talk about the Marty Baron origin story. So you graduated from Lehigh, you had a degree in journalism, but also an MBA. Yeah. So you had the credentials to take a career that would be the highest paying career in our capitalist economy, and yet you chose journalism. Why did a smart guy like you choose this profession?
Well, that's assuming I would have succeeded in business, which was no guarantee. Look, I always wanted to be a journalist. I was the editor of my high school paper. I became the editor of my college paper. I really wanted to go into journalism. I thought that the reason I took the MBA is Lehigh had a five-year arts MBA program. I had a ton of advanced placement credits, and I figured if I did it right, and if I got a waiver to take graduate level courses before I got my undergraduate degree, I could finish up in 4 years. I came up with a bunch of reasons, all of which were kind of fabricated, and they gave me the waiver, and so I finished up in 4 years. And the idea was that journalism was becoming more specialized, so business would be very helpful there. But if this journalism thing didn't work out, maybe I could go into business and I could fall back on it. And, you know, there were recruiters on campus, but there were no recruiters for journalism at Lehigh. But I did go to a couple of sessions with some recruiters for business, And one of them said, "You're doing this journalism stuff. What do you really want to do with your life?" And mm-hmm. I said, "Well, I really want to be a journalist." And he said, "Why don't you just go do that?" And so that was the last interview I had with a recruiter.
Well, I would say the journalism thing worked out okay.
It did. It did. You know, it was a bad year for journalism. I mean, 1976 was a recession year. That's when I graduated. Mm-hmm. So I say that the year I entered journalism was a bad year for journalism. It's been a bad year every year since. And I made a whole career out of it.
The Washington Post that you joined in 2013 was, talk about a bad year for journalism. It had had many bad years leading up to when you took it over. It was not the Washington Post that you left. It wasn't the Washington Post that inspired many of us to go into journalism. That wasn't the heroic post of the Watergate era, for example. What was it like when you got there in terms of its finances, the staff, morale, the mission, the sense of mission, and what did you resolve to do to improve that?
Well, the staff morale was terrible because the finances were terrible, and they had been going through years and years of cutbacks. A lot of people had been leaving to go elsewhere, particularly the New York Times, which was its arch rival, and people felt that we're never going to catch up to the New York Times, you know, and that the Post had seen its best days. The Post did not, I mean, when I was hired, I went through a round of interviews with the senior executives, including the publisher, the president, all of those people. And finally, I said, "Well, can I ask a question? Do you have a strategy for getting out of this hole?" And they said, "Well, we actually don't. We're working on it. We're trying to figure it out." And they didn't have a strategy, and they didn't know how to get out of the hole that they, financial hole that they were in, which is why Don Graham, whose family had owned the Post for 80 years, decided to sell, is because they didn't see a way out. And so it was terribly demoralized. And my view was, you know, I mean, I was asked when I first met the staff, they opened it up for questions. And the first question, of course, is, are there going to be more cuts? And I said, well, and I'm pretty blunt in these circumstances. I said, well, why don't you tell me what the revenue will be, and I'll tell you what the hiring situation will be. If we get more revenue, they'll probably be, we probably will grow. If we have less revenue, we're going to shrink. And then the publisher said, okay, well, why don't we wrap it up with questions? We're done. But I felt that, you know, the staff really needed a reality check. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're supposed to deal with reality in the journalism business, and we should be understand the reality of our own business. But my view is that we could still turn it around journalistically. As I told the staff, you know, the New York Times could be the U.S. Army, the lumbering U.S. Army, and we could be special forces. Mm-hmm. We could, you know, sort of engage in guerrilla tactics, journalistic guerrilla tactics, picking our shots, beating them on things that that were really important to us, and that we needed to decide what those were, and then go get it. And that's kind of what we did, even before Jeff Bezos acquired the Post.
You noted that great investigative stories seem to follow you, and there was one that arrived shortly after you started the Post, the Snowden revelations.
Yeah, Edward Snowden had leaked these documents. We were approached by a former reporter for the Post, a longtime reporter, an excellent reporter for the Post, who had won the Pulitzer, Bart Gellman. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. He approached some people, said that he had been in contact with someone who had the most, frankly, highly confidential national security documents in the U.S. government. They revealed a widespread surveillance program that pulled in the private data of individual Americans, people who were not terrorists. And so under the notion of under the idea of a program, a surveillance program that was designed to unearth potential terrorists, they were pulling in the data of an enormous number of Americans. And he wanted to know whether we would be interested in that and we would publish such a story. And it was a difficult decision. I mean, I had been in Boston at the time of the 9/11 attacks. They occurred 6 weeks after I got there. Two of those planes, the two planes that brought down the World Trade Center towers, right, came out of Boston. The father of our own Moscow correspondent was killed on one of those planes. I went to his memorial service. So highly conscious of, you know, the risks of terrorism and concerned that we would do something that might facilitate that. On the other hand, I also felt that this was an incredibly expansive surveillance regime, and that I really value the idea of individual privacy, and I think it's really important. And I thought we really need to think ahead to how this can be abused if somebody would choose to abuse it. And I think we can think of that today, perhaps more vividly than we could in the past. Access to an enormous amount of private information in the hands of intelligence agencies that report to the President of the United States, and what are the risks of that? And I felt that, you know, this is a surveillance program that would continue to grow and grow and grow and encompass, get more and more information about citizens throughout the world, including citizens of the United States. And I felt that it was important that we disclose this information. I knew that there were potential huge risks attendant to that. There could be huge fines against the Washington Post, potential prosecution and imprisonment, not just for me, but for the senior leaders of the Post, including Don Graham, the CEO of the parent company. But I made a decision to go ahead, and we then did publish those stories. The Guardian also had received those documents, and we did publish, and it led to reform. President Obama, at the time, acknowledged that there was a need for reform. The intelligence agencies were outraged by the whole thing, of course. But we also had a system where it's a policy at the Post that if we're going to publish national security information, we go to the intelligence agencies, tell them what we intend to publish, and give them an opportunity to argue against it and give us their rationale. And we never publish the names of any intelligence agents. We never give their locations. We don't give the locations of listening facilities and things of that sort. And so there are certain details that we withhold, and we did have a conversations with the intelligence agencies. Not that they considered them to be conversations so much. They weren't very pleased with the outcome. That said, there have been reforms, and in fact, support for reforms came from both sides, both political parties, and so we made that decision, and it was a very difficult and sensitive decision. But, you know, in this country, we have no prior constitutional protections for the press, no prior restraint on what we publish. We can suffer the consequences for what we publish afterward, but no prior restraint. And so a decision of that momentous fell to me, who I hadn't been involved in national security matters before. I had been with local papers. Some of those stories were national in their import, but this was a new territory for me. I did talk to other people on the staff, of course, who had been involved in those stories, but it was an incredibly, incredibly difficult decision to
make.
Sure.
And you had the backing of the Graham, the ownership.
Yeah, I told them about it. I told them in advance, and they supported me. You know, I did, for the book, I actually went back and talked to Don Graham about, you know, why he supported me, and he said, well, you know, I trusted you, and I trusted Bart Gellman, whom he had known for many years, and I trusted the other editors, and so it was okay. That was a lot of trust.
Your book, which I highly recommend to everybody who's interested in this topic or in the future of democracy and the information environment, is full of amazing how I got that story kind of anecdotes. And they're all kind of dramatic because they are, and that's why they end up as movies in many cases.
Right. The ones that weren't dramatic, I didn't include in the book, by the way.
One of them, we could go on forever, but I would like you to do one of them. Tell us about one of them. And that was the Roy Moore case, which kind of stretched across a whole lot of things and ended up with what you described as one of the most bizarre attempts to squash the story that you ever encountered.
Sure. It's a long story, so I'm going to try to keep it as brief as possible.
Please.
So State Supreme Court Justice Roy Moore had decided to run for the Senate, the seat that he would replace Jeff Sessions, who had been named the Attorney General by Donald Trump. Roy Moore was very much supported by Steve Bannon. It was his way of disrupting the Republican establishment because the establishment candidate was running against Roy Moore. Roy Moore was famous for having built a granite monument to the Ten Commandments at the courthouse, and then refusing to take it down, refusing a federal court order to take it down. He was then removed from his position as a state justice. He then ran for re-election, and then he refused to allow clerks to permit marriage licenses for same-sex couples, despite the U.S. Supreme Court ruling permitting same-sex marriages. And he was then suspended for that purpose, too, in the state of Alabama. And he ran, and so he had a lot of support, and one of our editors decided to send one of our reporters, Stephanie McCrumman, to Alabama to find out why there was so much support for someone like Roy Moore in Alabama. She herself came from an evangelical background. She grew up in Alabama. But in the process of talking to people, somebody said, you know, Roy Moore, he likes the young girls. And she was... sort of noted that. That's not what she was there to write about. But she then discovered that there was a young woman who could, or now an older woman who could talk to her about that and did talk to her about it. And she described how Roy Moore had actually had sexual relations with her when she was underage. And then she came upon other people, other women who, while they weren't underage, they were really, really young. And that Roy Moore, while he was an assistant district attorney, I think it was, that he would like prowl the mall looking for young women. So we pulled in an additional reporter because it was getting close to the election. We needed to get this story done very quickly. And we produced a story that laid this out. And of course, it was an enormous story and very, needless to say, disruptive to his campaign. So immediately there was efforts to discredit the Washington. There were efforts to discredit the Washington Post. Fake calls to people saying, "We'll pay you money. We're with the Washington Post. We'll pay you money if you give us dirt on Roy Moore." Things like that. But then we got a call from a young woman who said that she had had an email from a young woman who said that she had had a relationship with Roy Moore and that he had paid for an abortion. There were questions about it. We asked her a lot of questions because we always work to verify all of this information. And ultimately, she wasn't using her real name. Finally, she did give us her real name, which was unusual. People often say, "I don't want my name used," but they don't just give a fake name. So we had a lot of suspicions about the veracity of this story. We did a big background check on her. We came across a GoFundMe account where she said she was moving up north in order to, participate in the cause of bringing down the mainstream media. So we're like, who's behind this person? Why is she doing this? And so she wanted to meet in Virginia, in Tyson's Corner, Virginia. She said she was visiting friends in Annapolis. Well, that's 50 miles difference, so we were suspicious about that, too. Like, why would that be? Well, because Virginia allows recording of conversations without two-party consent. And so it was what we suspected. So we're like, well, who's doing this? So we arranged to do a sting of our own while she was trying to do a sting on us. And so we had our video team go down. They met in a place called the Souvlaki Bar in Tyson's Corner, and we recorded it. And we got our ID. We could see who she was. We could see where she lived, all that sort of stuff. Anyway, we became very suspicious. We also then, she started to leave, so we had somebody outside who was in a car to tail her, but then she crossed a highway, went into a Target store, turned around, we lost her. I mean, our reporter like ran across the highway, all this sort of stuff, totally. Anyway, we knew where she lived, so we then staked her out at her place, and we followed her into work, and she ended up at Project Veritas, this outfit, which was then run by James O'Keefe, funded by very ultra-right individuals. And then we confronted James O'Keefe when he came out of the office. And so we had our story that it was Project Veritas that was trying to smear us and invent a story and hoping that we would fall for it and publish it. And so we ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize for that all that work. And yes. I was very tempted to send James O'Keefe a thank you note for helping us. Project Veritas has now collapsed because there were questions raised about how he managed the money, but he still has the support of a lot of wealthy people on the far right, and he's trying to reconstitute himself, and he'll raise money for that.
Yes, and he won't go away. And by the way, Roy Moore was defeated in his...
He was defeated, yeah, and for the first time in, I can't recall how many years, Doug Jones, a Democrat, won. He was then defeated. It was a special election, so he was defeated subsequently, but it was the first time in a long time. Okay. A Democrat had been elected in Alabama to a federal office.
So that was a good story, wasn't it? I mean, that was worth it. So, but enough kind of editorial spycraft. Let's get down to the question that really everyone wants to answer, which is, you have been closely associated with two of the most powerful men in the world. And there's a reason they're in the title of your book. One of them is running for president right now. And, it's hard to escape the impression on reading your book that you have higher esteem for one of those people for the other. So let's start with the other. The book opens with a dinner at the White House.
Yeah.
What was it like having dinner with President Trump?
Sure. Well, I wasn't really associated with him, by the way, just to be clear. So this is a dinner. It's about 5 months after I arrived at the Post. Our publisher thought it was a good idea for us to meet with Trump. I hadn't met him. He hadn't met him. Here we were, the biggest news outlet in the nation's capital, new president. And he thought it would be a good idea if Jeff Bezos joined us for that dinner. And it was probably a way of getting Trump to agree to that dinner in the first place. So it was Jeff Bezos, the publisher, myself, our editorial page editor. Then at the dinner was Trump, Melania, Jared Kushner. And Ivanka was supposed to attend, but she didn't because there was the Steve Scalise had been shot. And so there was a congressional baseball game, and she went to that instead of Trump. In any event, it was very, you know, he was superficially charming, I mean, and not impolite in any way. But during the entire dinner, I was seated to his left, and he was, Bezos was directly across, and Trump did, this may not surprise you, Trump did almost all the talking. Hardly any of us said anything during the entire dinner. He just talked. And the usual stuff, you know, how he defeated the Clinton machine, he defeated the Bush machine, how the economy had immediately turned around after he came into office, how he, you know, all these things. And he was talking to Bezos the whole time, and he would criticize the Washington Post as being the absolute worst media outlet. And every time he would criticize the Post, he would, like, elbow me like this. And I was very tempted to, you know, do that. And it was clear that, I mean, I was very worried about this dinner because Trump was very transactional. If he did us the honor of giving us, of having dinner with us, he was going to expect something in return. And more importantly than that, we had been saying all along correctly that Bezos was not involved in our news coverage. And Trump would interpret his presence there as signaling that he was involved in our, involved in our news coverage. And if word got out that we had this dinner, then the public would think and the press would say, well, he really is involved in the news coverage. So I was deeply uncomfortable with this. And, you know, my my worries about Trump being transactional were confirmed the next day when Trump called Bezos and immediately at 8 o'clock in the morning on his cell phone and said, can't you do something to make the Post more fair to me? Mm. And Bezos said, well, I don't get involved in the news coverage. This is what he had prepared for the night we had dinner, but he didn't. There was an opportunity to say it. I don't get involved in the news coverage, and if I did, I would regret it for the rest of my life. Anyway, the conversation went on for a little bit longer, and at the end, Trump said, if there's anything you ever need, just give me a call. It's kind of an invitation to ask for a favor, which Bezos thankfully never did. And then Trump called me a couple of other times after that, complaining about stories about him. He had just gotten out of a dinner with Narendra Modi of India, and he called what was on his mind. The Post coverage. So he called to complain. He said he said the story had portrayed him as being a little boy, and then he said these words that I never expected the President of the United States to ever say. He said, "I am not a little boy," which was very weird, very strange. And then he called a couple of days later about another story, and he said that this was all me telling the reporters to do this. This was all Bezos doing it. Amazon was behind this. And I'd heard this throughout the entire campaign through the first few months of his presidency, and I said, finally, I just said, well, that's not true, and you know it's not true. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he's actually accustomed to people speaking to him that way. And he then broke out in a bunch of profanities, said that we were a big fat lie, that we were nothing but a hate machine, all of that. And then this so-called conversation went on for, I don't know, 25 minutes, something like that. And I was just like looking at the time thinking, I don't know about the President of the United States, but I actually have other things to do today. So, and I kind of said, finally just ended it by thanking him for calling me and offering his perspective. And I never heard from him again. Ah. So,
reading the book, my experience was a lot like reliving kind of the worst of the Trump years, kind of a PTSD experience. And that's just as a citizen, I didn't have to cover him. And what were the challenges of covering a president so unlike any other?
Well, you know, I mean, I think the biggest challenge is that there's so many untruths. I mean, that's the thing. And I think that's obviously a theme that runs throughout my book, is just how consistent they were in terms of not telling the truth, outright lying in many instances, fabricating things. It was just a pattern around of his own and everybody around him. And so that's something that you always expect a president or any politician to spin things. That's what they do. But to sort of just outright lie and have that level of deceit all of the time is really challenging to deal with, because you don't really want to be in the position of constantly saying the president's a liar, the president's a liar, all of that. It seems disrespectful, but ultimately, if that's the case, you have the obligation to do so. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, of course, he was attacking us regularly. And you have to distance yourself from that, saying, look, we're going to cover him the way we would cover anybody, whether he's attacking us or not. But he was systematically endeavoring to undermine confidence in anything that we wrote and anything that any mainstream media outlet would write or broadcast. And he said he acknowledged that early on to Leslie Stahl of CBS. She asked, why do you keep attacking the press? And he said, I do it so that when you publish stuff that isn't favorable to me, that nobody will believe you. Mm-hmm. And that's the strategy. And he has since celebrated his achievements in hurting the credibility of the press. He's called it one of his greatest achievements as president of the United States.
Well, he has certainly done that, and he certainly succeeded if that was his goal. And
he did succeed.
I want to ask a tougher question, though, which is, to what extent do you think that journalistic practices may have contributed in the things that we did in our profession might have given people excuses to say, maybe Trump has a point?
Well, I think there are a lot of practices that I've been very concerned about, which I talk about at length in the book, particularly in the last several chapters, that have bothered me. I don't think it's a basis for that Trump has a point. On the other hand, I don't think that we help our own case. In many instances, in almost all instances, Trump was attacking us, saying that things were fake news that were actually validated. They were totally verified. You know, they're rock solid. And he would say they're not true. And so I don't think he had much of a point, per se, but I think that we hurt ourselves over time. I think what happened is that a lot of, particularly younger journalists, became very concerned about Trump's assault on what we would normally be viewed as core values in the journalism profession. Number one, free expression, free press, democracy, tolerance for all people, basic civility, not inciting violence, things like that. And people saw him as being at war with us. And some journalists came to feel that, well, we're at war with him. I mean, I made a statement early on in his administration. I said that, you know, we're not at war with the administration. We're at work. And I said that because it was right after, on his first full day of work, he went to the CIA. And standing in front of a memorial to fallen CIA agents, you know, what did he choose to talk about? Well, of course, the press, right? And he said, as you know, I have a running war with the media, seeming to want to enlist intelligence agents in the war against the media. And I was asked a few weeks after that, well, what was my reaction? And I said, well, we're not at war with the administration, we're at work. And my view was, you know, well, what is that work? The work is why we have a First Amendment, why we have a free and independent press in this country. And, you know, James Madison, who was the principal author of the First Amendment, talked about freely examining public characters and measures. So, you know, free is understandable. Public characters, government officials, politicians, people who influence them, measures, the policies. But the important word is examining. And that is that journalism is not stenography. Mm-hmm. You know, we're supposed to look beneath the surface, behind the curtain, who's doing what, why, you know, who influenced those decisions, who's going to be affected by those decisions, things of that sort. And so I view that as the original assignment for the press. It's the very reason that we have a free and independent press in this country. And so, but a lot of journalists they saw it as a war, and they started to act that way. And particularly on social media, with comments that I thought were inappropriate, were expressions of opinion, expressions of outrage, outrage to this, outrage about that. And I felt like that behavior was really inappropriate for us. And in fact, it directly violated our own guidelines for behavior. And I think it undermined and does have, in fact, a corrosive effect on our own credibility. And I found myself very much in conflict with the staff about that. There were a couple of uprisings against me, that's all. And one petition signed by about 450 journalists and our staff who were upset with my enforcement of our social media guidelines. And all of that behavior, I thought, was just not professional. I mean, my view is that our job is we need to behave like professionals at all times. Our job is not to engage in combat. Our job is to engage in journalism. And so we needed to exercise, all of the people on the staff needed to exercise greater self-control, self-discipline, self-awareness. And I didn't think they were doing that. And I thought that they were having a, even though it might have been an expression of their own individual opinion, first of all, they not supposed to be expressing their individual opinion. Secondly, I don't care what their individual opinion is. I'm caring about how they report. And third, it was having an impact on the reputation of the overall institution. Mm-hmm. And so that concerned me a lot. And I do think that has hurt us with the public.
We're about to see a replay of the campaign that you covered in 2020. What's your advice to your successors and other people in the profession covering the presidential election that's just unfolding?
Yeah, well, let's focus on what the two candidates, they've just locked up their nominations, big surprise, what they would do with another 4 years. Mm-hmm. So certainly we need to cover, journalists need to cover what Biden would do with another 4 years. I don't think he's been terribly clear about that, but we should report on that. And I say we, I'm unemployed. I'm not going to work every day anymore. But with Trump, he's been quite open about what he intends to do and has talked quite, expansively about it. And he's also retained the Heritage Foundation, has done a lot of work to prepare him for that. And what he's describing is, by definition, authoritarian. I mean, it's not an opinion. It's just like if you were to look up the definition of authoritarianism, these would be all the measures that one would take. So he's talked about, I mean, he's the only politician I've heard talking about, in the context of the 2020 election, he talked about suspending the Constitution.
Yes.
Termination is actually the word that he used. I mean, that's shocking. He did take an oath to defend the Constitution, too. He may have forgotten. He's talked about using the military to suppress perfectly legitimate protests, invoking the Insurrection Act. He's talked about bringing treason charges against the then-outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, and most likely that he should be executed. He's talked about bringing treason charges against Comcast, which is the owner of NBC and MSNBC, for coverage that he deems to be unfavorable to him. He's talked about eliminating the civil service and implanting his own loyalists throughout government so that they can do his bidding. He continues to talk about going after the press and destroying the press. And he's talked about wanting to lock up journalists so that, as he puts it, they can meet their bride in prison. So basically that they would, celebrating the idea that they might be subject to sexual assault in prison. So all those things are authoritarian in nature. And we should be doing more reporting about what another 4 years of Donald Trump would be like, as well as reporting on what another 4 years of Joe Biden would be like. But the more we focus on that, and not so much on polls, although, politics is a horse race. You can't ignore it. But I think what would another 4 years look like is the area of primary focus.
Thank you. Let's turn to questions from the audience.
Do you think Trump could implement any of these lunatic ideas that you just listed if he wins the election again?
Yeah, I think he could implement most of them, frankly. He's talked about being a dictator on day one. What does that mean? I mean, at least he hasn't explained himself. But I think it means that there's a series of executive orders that's just is ready for him to sign, and he's going to sign them. And there will be legislation that he would send to Congress. I mean, he would hope, of course, that the House and the Senate would be controlled by the Republican Party. The Republican Party today is the Trump Party. They might as well rename it. So he would hope that all of those things would go through right away, and that I think he would do that. I mean, I'm pretty sure that he'll with regard to the press, I'm quite sure that he's going to prosecute the press for national security. Whenever they report on classified documents, that he will prosecute them. And that he will probably, I mean, the level of classification in the U.S. government is already incredibly expansive. I mean, so many things are classified that never should be, including like stories that have appeared in the press get classified, believe it or not. So he'll probably, my guess is he's going to classify more. I mean, remember that at the beginning of his term, he actually had a lot of people on his staff sign non-disclosure agreements. Now, those were not enforceable, ultimately, but that's the mentality that he had, is that anything he says or anything anybody says, anything, that it should never be disclosed. So my guess is that he'll probably increase the amount of classification of documents so that the press reports any of it. He's going to argue that it's a violation of national security laws. My guess is he would also systematically try to undermine the economic base of an already weak American media, financially weak American media, so that when they're weak enough, that his allies will then buy those media outlets and they will become basically his sort of outlets that are supportive of him. Keep in mind what he did with the Voice of America. He threw out the entire senior ranks, and including some of the reporter, many of the reporters of Voice of America, and he put in his own partisan there. If you look today, the owner of the, the Sinclair Broadcasting is very much a pro-Trump kind of organization. They deny it, but that's the evidence suggests they are. And the CEO of Sinclair just bought the Baltimore Sun, which was a weakened, very much weakened local newspaper. So I think you would see a lot more of that. I mean, that's what happens in authority. You take a look at what happens in Venezuela, what happened in Venezuela, what's happened in Hungary. That's exactly what happens. They weaken the press. The allies, business allies, buy it. Businesses are reward. Business executives who do that are rewarded in other ways for those kinds of acquisitions. They get the government contracts. I also believe that he will punish businesses that. I mean, the book is I talk a lot about how he went after Bezos because he wanted to put pressure on us. So he talked about early on about doubling, tripling, and then quadrupling the postal rates so that Amazon would, you know, be hurt. He then interfered, of course, in a big $10 billion Defense Department cloud computing contract where Amazon was the leading bidder. He wanted to make sure that Amazon didn't get it. So he was trying to punish Bezos for the Post and our coverage, even though Bezos wasn't involved in that coverage. And he did that with AT&T, with its merger with Time Warner. They had the Justice Department go after them, or at least that's a suspicion of AT&T. And in other instances, and they've talked, the people in the Republican Party have talked quite openly about that. I mean, even Kevin McCarthy at one point said that, you know, any telecommunications company that participated, that cooperated with the January 6th hearings, even under a legal subpoena, that they were going to go after those companies. I mean, that's authoritarian. I mean,
Could someone ask a question that gets an optimistic answer? Tom.
I always lift people's spirits when I do talks.
You went into the Boston Globe, and you managed Ben Bradley Jr., and then you took over the Washington Post, where his dad was. Do you have a relationship other than that tenure at the Globe with the Bradley family, and how nepotism in journalism?
Well, I don't think that was nepotism in journalism, because Ben Bradley Jr., his son, I think mostly his mother raised him. They were split. He was working at the Globe. He wasn't working at the Washington Post. So I don't think that qualifies as nepotism. And Ben Bradley Jr. is a very fine journalist and was totally qualified for the position that he had at the Globe, and has since written a couple of books, good books. So, I knew Sally Quinn. So I knew Ben Bradley, the elder Ben Bradley, a little bit. I mean, frankly, his mental faculties had really deteriorated at that point. People at the Post would have like a lunch with him, and they would invite people to come join, and I would join a couple of times. And I was at a party. I would have parties at their house and in Georgetown. But I knew Sally Quinn, his wife, quite well, and do. But I don't think that qualified as nepotism, frankly. I mean, I do think that media should figure out how to support itself. I don't think it's going to survive unless it does. I don't think that the American public is willing to pay the bill to support news organizations. And anyway, how do you define what's a news organization? I mean, what qualifies as journalism? Who is a journalist? We still haven't answered those questions. I mean, how is the public really going to support this kind of stuff? I mean, I don't think most of the American public, if you were to ask them, say, yes, I'd like you to increase I'd like my tax dollars to go support the media. Probably the answer is no, a firm no. So I don't think that's going to happen. So I think media has to figure out how to support itself. Some are succeeding pretty well, you know, and the Post had six straight years of profitability after Jeff Bezos' acquisition. It's had problems more recently, but I think it has the capacity to turn itself around for sure. There are other metro papers that are doing okay. I think in Minneapolis and Boston, in San Francisco, places like that, they're doing pretty well. And there's some nonprofits that are doing reasonably well. But now you see the emergence of different kinds of news organizations, some that are organized more thematically, like covering politics, covering education, covering sort of special technology, things like that. Now an outfit called like Platformer, which has had quite a bit of success, or The Information, which covers the intersection of technology and media, and all those have had some success. The biggest challenge is, of course, local news. You know that very well here in Chicago. So that's a huge challenge. I think we're in a period of radical reinvention of the press and how information is communicated. And we as a profession are going to have to figure that out and adapt to that and embrace it, even as we do serious work and hold to traditional values. I don't think that our profession has been way too resistant to change over time and way too resistant. And we'll have to do work that people are willing to pay for. We'll have to provide value, and people say it actually adds value to their lives. So even the nonprofits are going to have to pay for themselves, I mean, ultimately pay for themselves either through donations or through sponsorships or something like that. You know, I mean, all of us in journalism, we think we're doing God's work, and some of us in journalism think that means that we should get manna from heaven. Sadly, that doesn't arrive. I keep looking up, and it's not coming down. So, you know, we'll just have to figure out how to do that. I mean, even if you're a nonprofit, you still have to make enough money to pay your bills and to invest in the future. When I was at the Boston Globe, when we were in our really deep trouble in 2009, one of the people on the staff said, well, wouldn't it be better if we were a nonprofit? And I said, we are. That's not our solution. That's our problem. So... it's hard to answer like specifically what fundamentally we need to adapt better to the way that people are consuming information. We need to provide news that's of great value to people in their day-to-day lives, and we need to get them to pay for it.
One last question.
Yeah, I think that younger people are just consuming information in a different way, and so we need to adapt to that. So it's not that they, so they're turning to social media in particular for information. I don't think it's the best thing to do, but turning to TikTok to understand the Middle East, probably not a good idea. On the other hand, you know, we need to, I find that this is a generation that's much more visual. We need to provide information in a more visual way. That means interactive graphics. That means videos, shorter videos, not documentaries. All the journalists like to do a documentary that win an award. But I've always noticed that it's a lot harder to win readers than it is to win prizes. So we need to focus on winning readers. And that is, you know, we're going to, even if it's a big project, for example, we need to be able to divide that into pieces that are like the appetizer. They would encourage them to read the bigger piece. And that goes against the grain of what a lot of traditional journalists have done, but it happens to be the way that younger people are consuming information, and we need to adapt to that. We also need to communicate information in a much more informal way, rather than, you know, we're the voice of God, we're, you know, traditional structures, things like that. More of a conversation. Those kinds of things have done actually quite well with younger people. And it's not that we haven't had success. I mean, at the Post, about 35% of our readers were millennials or younger, Gen Z. So, you know, that was encouraging to be able to see that. Now, among subscribers, that's a lot less. So what we need to do is take those readers and make them subscribers. One thing, I mean, trust is a complicated, I don't have to tell you, it's a really complicated subject. And, I mean, some people just trust the outlets that tell them what they already, that's going to affirm their pre-existing point of view. Not much we can really do about that. But I think if we actually reach people in the way that they like to consume information, we will do a lot better at inspiring trust in ourselves.
On that note of trust, let us thank Marty. This has been great.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening all the way through. If you share our concern for truth and democracy, please subscribe and leave a review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen. It will help spread the message. And please don't hesitate to give me feedback at eric@ericschorenberg.com. I'd love to hear from you in truth and in reality.